Seems really hard to believe. But in 4 more weeks, we're going to be going to the Feast of Tabernacles. 4 weeks. It's right around the corner. It really has a way of sneaking up on us, doesn't it? It comes around so quickly. It's certainly a joyous and an exciting time of the year when God's holy days come around. These holy days give us much needed break from our normal daily routine. And here we are, we're in September now, September the 1st, and we're just 16 days from the Feast of Trumpets. And 9 days later, it's Day of Atonement. And then the Feast of Tabernacles starts on the night of the 30th. Certainly is a wonderful time of the year, and God designed these days to fall when they're most needed. The feast is a time of year that brings much anticipation. We look forward to it. We get excited about it. We tell our children about it, and they get excited. But the feast is also a time that requires a lot of planning and a lot of preparation. Now, if you've kept the feast for 20 or 30 or 40 years, there's a hazard that you need to look out for. And that is the fact that because you've done it for so long, And so many times, do we just let these days happen? Do we just keep the feast out of habit, out of tradition? These days carry with them great spiritual meaning. And unlike all of the worldly holidays that pretty much are just an excuse to have a party. Now, I want to ask you, what is St. Patrick's Day? Why do we have a day called St. Patrick's Day? Isn't that just another excuse to have a party? I don't know too many people that really know much about it, but there's a lot of people that'll go down to the local pub and get some of that green beer that they pour out that time of year. Most of the holidays that this world observes stem from some ancient pagan ritual. I think we're aware of that, and I don't need to go there. I don't need to talk about that. God's holy days, on the other hand, have meaning and substance. There's a purpose to them. There's a reason why God tells us to observe them. They are vital to the spiritual growth and development of God's people. They are absolutely vital. But after keeping them for so long, does the meaning get a little bit diluted? Are we keeping them more out of our own tradition? Do we let the importance diminish to the point where maybe we even slack off in our attendance of God's feast days? Maybe they don't seem as important for us to attend. No matter how long you've been in the church, you need to review some things about God's holy days and specifically how important they are. We need a periodic refresher on the importance of God's holy days. And there's something even more important that we need to review about the holy days as well, which I'll get to that shortly. But right now I want to talk about the importance of keeping God's holy days. There are certain days of the year that are designated as very important to God. I'd like you to turn to Leviticus chapter 23. And when we finish reading verse 2, put a marker in there because we're going to come back to this chapter a couple of times. Leviticus chapter 23, verse 2. God is speaking to Moses, and he gives him an instruction. Verse 2, he says, "Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, the feasts of the Lord, which you shall proclaim to be holy convocations, these are my feasts." I'd like to analyze one specific word in this verse, and that is the word feasts. The word feast is translated from the Hebrew word moed. Moed. That Hebrew word literally means an appointed time or meeting. In other words, on these special feast days, we have an appointment with God. God has set up an appointment and He expects us to keep it. We have an obligation to be there to keep our appointment. If you have an appointment, how important is it to you that you be there and that you be there on time? If you have a job interview, wouldn't you make sure that you showed up on time? You want to put your best foot forward. You want to look like you're punctual, even if you're not. You want to give that appearance. But we want to be prompt. If you have a meeting with a client, and maybe it's an important client, and one that could bring you a lot of business, you want to make sure you're not late for that meeting. You want to make sure that you're there. What about if you're planning on going to an event, maybe something that you have tickets for, like a play or a ball game? Or maybe it's something like you're going to a surprise party for a friend. You don't want to show up late for that, because then the surprise might be on you. Anywhere where people are counting on you to be there, you pretty much want to make sure that you're there, don't you? You want to make sure that nothing stands in the way of you being where you said you would be, where you have committed yourself to being. How much more important is it that we keep our appointment with God? This appointment takes precedence over all other appointments. No matter what other appointment you may have, this one is more important. This one takes precedence because it was established before all other appointments. And because this appointment is an appointment with the Creator of all things and your Heavenly Father. He ordained it, He established it, and He expects us to be there for it. When were these appointments originally established? When did this come into existence? There are some who will say, well, that started with the Old Covenant. That started in the time of Moses. I'm here to tell you that these days predate Moses by thousands of years. These days have been around longer than that. I'm going to show you why I say that. I'd like you to turn and hold your place in Leviticus, but turn to Genesis 1, verse 14. Genesis 1:14 says, "Then God said, let there be lights in the firmament of the heavens to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and seasons and for days and years." Now, this was day 4 of the recreation of earth. This was 2 days prior to the creation of Adam. We know that the heavenly bodies, the sun and the moon and all the stars and all the things that we see out in the sky at night, they already existed. They existed prior to this. This is not the creation of these lights in the firmament. We know that the heavenly bodies existed on day 1 when God said, "Let there be light," and sunlight shone through the atmosphere and finally reached the earth. And even that wasn't the beginning of the heavenly bodies. That was just making them shine on the earth, making them visible. So the heavenly bodies already existed. But on day 4 of earth's recreation, notice what it says here, "Let there be lights in the firmament of the heavens to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and seasons and for days and years." Think about that for a second. What is God doing here? He's not creating these heavenly bodies. He is appointing them, or he is using them to set apart something. He's using them as markers. On the fourth day of Earth's recreation, these heavenly bodies were set apart as signs, or set apart for signs and seasons and days and years. The word signs, the Hebrew word that is used here is oath, which literally means a distinguishing mark or remembrance. These days were marked by heavenly bodies. The heavenly bodies were designed to cross the sky from the observer's viewpoint on Earth at a certain rate, at a certain interval, to mark out days and signs and seasons. This word signs means a distinguishing mark or remembrance. The word seasons is the Hebrew word moed, the same word that is translated feasts in Leviticus 23. That same word is used here and is translated into English as seasons. God is hereby designating appointment times. On the fourth day, 2 days before Adam is created, the appointment was set. Days and years. The Hebrew words here are yom and shana. These literally mean days and years and are for the purpose of keeping track of time, keeping track of how many days have gone by and where the year begins and ends, and the months, the beginning and ending of each month. Astronomical events were ordained to mark out the calendar and to determine God's holy days, these appointments that he was ordaining with mankind. It was so important to God that it was one of his first acts in recreating the earth. God was about to create man 2 days later, and these days would be significant in the creation of man because they would represent everything that God was about to do. They would outline God's plan for his new creation. Man would be able to understand why he was here by understanding God's plan for him. And these holy days, these appointments, spell out that plan for us. These appointments were then reiterated thousands of years later to Moses. Back to Leviticus 23. We'll read verse 4 now. Leviticus 23, verse 4, it says, "These are the feasts of the Lord, holy convocations which you shall proclaim at their appointed times." These are the feasts of the Lord. Now notice what God did not say. God didn't say, "These shall be the feasts of the Lord." He said, "These are the feasts of the Lord." He wasn't ordaining them at that time. He wasn't instituting the holy days then. These are the feasts. They already existed. This was not the beginning of them. They already existed as feasts or appointments of God, or appointments with God. The Hebrew word moed is used 2 times in this verse. These are the moed, the feasts of the Lord, holy convocations which you shall proclaim at their moed, their appointed times. These are your appointments with God. Skip down to verse 44. So Moses declared to the children of Israel the feasts of the Lord, the moed, the appointments of the Lord. This doesn't say that Moses established the holy days with the Israelites. It says he declared the feasts of God to the Israelites. He declared them to the children of Israel. He didn't create them. He didn't receive a message from God saying he's going to institute these. He's declaring something that was already in place. And Moses was declaring them to the Israelites. Did people keep God's festivals prior to the time of Moses? Do we read anywhere in the Bible where these days must have existed because people are observing them? There is just a hint of what may have been a holy day service. And we can't say for sure, but it certainly seems as though it probably had something to do with the holy day. And for that, we'll go back to Genesis chapter 4 and verse 3. Of course, Genesis chapter 4 is the chapter that deals with the story of Cain and Abel. And as we start to read about the story of Cain and Abel and the offerings that they made, this is what it says in verse 3. And in the process of time, it came to pass that Cain brought an offering of the fruit of the ground to the Lord. I won't read any verses after that. You know what happens. Abel had an offering, and God accepted Abel's but not Cain's, and then you know the story after that. But the important thing is what it says here. And in the process of time, it came to pass that Cain brought an offering. In the process of time. What does that mean? In the process of time. That word process is the Hebrew word kates, which literally means end, the ending. In the process or in the ending of time. The word time here is a word that we saw just a few minutes ago when we were in Genesis 1. The Hebrew word yom, which literally means days. Given that meaning for these two Hebrew words, we could also translate this verse, and in the end of the days. In the end of what days? What is it talking about here? In the end of the days, these offerings were made. Cain and Abel made their offerings at the end of the days. There was a specific timeline regarding these offerings. Now, we don't know if this was a holy day offering. We don't know if it was the weekly Sabbath. At the end of the days could have meant at the end of the week, the seventh day. It could mean at the end when the feast was ending, or the end of the Feast of Tabernacles, or anything like that. But apparently there was some kind of specific timeline regarding these offerings. Now, it's true that the holy days are not mentioned in the Bible by name prior to the time of Moses. But that is not an indication that the days were not kept. And let me show you why. Can you tell me of any instance before Abraham's time when people prayed to God? Can you think of any instance where people prayed to God? I think we would all agree that people, probably not most people, but some people at some point prayed to God during the first 2,000 years of man's existence, prior to Abraham. There is no record in the Bible of anyone praying to God prior to Genesis 20. If you do a search on the word prayer, on the word pray, prayed, praying, prayers, any variation of the word pray, you will find that the first instance of that word is Genesis chapter 20. Are we to assume then that no one prayed before Genesis chapter 20, which was 2,000 years into man's existence? Halfway between Adam and Jesus Christ we're talking about. And no one prayed? I don't expect anyone to believe that. And just because the Bible doesn't mention it, doesn't mean it didn't happen. So we can't say that because the holy days aren't mentioned by name, that they didn't exist back then. But it certainly does seem that this offering that we read about in Genesis 4 had something to do with a specific timeline, and more than likely had a relationship with either the Sabbath or the holy days. The holy days picture the plan of God, and they help us to understand it. Just ask anyone who has stopped keeping them what these days picture. I think we've known many people who have left the church and gone off on their own and not attended church anymore. Stopped keeping the holy days. Ask them if they remember what they mean. If you stop observing the days, you will lose their meaning. And if we lose sight of the meaning of these days, we lose hope. These days are a part of the way that God wants us to worship Him. They give a detailed outline of His plan for mankind. And by observing them, we acknowledge our part in that plan. And we honor God by our acceptance of our part in that plan. Now, there's no question that keeping the feast can be a little bit costly. If you've been going to the feast for many years, you know that it takes a lot of money. It takes effort to go to the feast. And even if we economize as tightly as we possibly can, it's still going to cost more to go to the feast than to not go to the feast. Because when we go to the Feast of Tabernacles and we keep the feast as God instructs, we usually find ourselves eating in a restaurant every day, or at least every other day. Maybe 50% of our meals are in restaurants. And that can get expensive. We go to the feast at a distant site, and the lodging for just 8 to 10 days costs anywhere from hundreds of dollars to thousands of dollars. Just getting to the feast and back home is no small expense. You know, transportation is not cheap, especially today. Having sufficient funds may require planning on your part. Having the amount of money you need to attend God's feast requires a lot of planning. Not planning to determine, well, how much am I going to need? Let's see if I can put it together. Because the amount you have available is predetermined. What you need to plan on is to determine how to keep the feast within your budget, how to keep it within the amount that is available. And a prime factor there is, well, how far do you have to travel? Now, your funds may not be sufficient to plan on a trip to St. Lucia for the feast. I wish mine were. That's one place I would really like to see. But they can go a long way at a more nearby site. Wherever you go, it's going to involve travel, it's going to involve lodging. The Feast of Tabernacles is intended to be a trip away from home. Let's go to John chapter 7. John chapter 7, and I'll read verses 2 and 3. It says, "Now the Jews' Feast of Tabernacles was at hand. His brothers therefore said to him, 'Depart from here and go into Judea, that your disciples also may see the works that you are doing.'" Then down in verse 10, it says, "But when his brothers had gone up, then he also went up to the feast, not openly, but as it were in secret." So his brothers went, they left home, they went to this place where the feast was being held. And then a few days later, he went as well. He followed them. Jesus Christ went a few days later than his brothers did. "But when he and when they went to the feast, they went out of town." They went to a distant place. It is appropriate to travel to the feast at a specific location. The idea of the Feast of Tabernacles is to dwell for a time in a temporary location. If you've still got a marker in Leviticus 23, we're going to go back there one more time. After this verse, you can take your marker out. You won't need it again. But in Leviticus 23, verse 34. It says here, "Speak to the children of Israel, saying, the 15th day of this seventh month shall be the Feast of Tabernacles for 7 days to the Lord." It is a Feast of Tabernacles. What does tabernacle mean? The Hebrew word here is sukkah, which means a rude or temporary shelter. Not something that you would live in permanently, but a temporary shelter or a temporary dwelling. What God calls the Feast of Tabernacles in the English translation is literally the Feast of Temporary Dwellings. We don't stay in our own homes during this time. Incidentally, the building where the feast is held is not the tabernacle. Okay, I remember back in the early 70s when I first started attending the feast, first two feasts I went to up in the Poconos. I remember that big metal building that we had, and we had anywhere from 13 to 15,000 people those first 2 years I was there. A lot of people in that building. And anywhere you went in the Poconos, you would run into church members. Just about every hotel we took over, we had all of them. We had members everywhere. You couldn't go anywhere in the area without running into church members. And I remember people talking about going to services tonight. Back in those days, we had two services every day. Sometimes they were morning and evening, sometimes afternoon and evening. I remember hearing people talk about going to the tabernacle, referring to the building where our services were held. And I always had a problem with that. Because I knew, even back then when I was new in the church, I knew that that's not the tabernacle. The tabernacle is the sukkah, the temporary dwelling. Your hotel room or your house or your condo is your tabernacle. The Feast of Tabernacles was meant to be a place where we go and stay in a temporary dwelling. The building where the feast is held is not the tabernacle. Now, there is a different word in the Bible that is also translated tabernacle. We see it in Exodus 25, verse 9. This particular Hebrew word is mishkan. Mishkan. It's not sukkah. It's mishkan. In Exodus 25, 9, it says, "According to all that I show you, that is, the pattern of the tabernacle and the pattern of all its furnishings, just so you shall make it." Mishkan refers to a residence, a dwelling, or a temple. The Feast of Tabernacles was the Feast of Sukkah, not the Feast of Mishkan. It was the Feast of Temporary Dwellings. Not a reference to the temple itself. But the intent is, it was a place that we would stay that would be temporary. That is the focus of this particular festival. And even if the feast is local, even if we had the feast right here in this local area, we shouldn't be staying in our homes. We should be staying in a temporary location. Because that's the purpose of this feast. It teaches us something. It teaches us that this world is our temporary home. That our citizenship is somewhere else. There were a number of people throughout the Bible who knew that and recognized that. People who were strong in faith. Those people are listed in Hebrews chapter 11. Let's turn there and read verses 13 and 14 and see what we're told about these people. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 13. says these all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland. This is not our homeland. Our citizenship is elsewhere. And this world is a temporary dwelling. That's one of the things the feast teaches us, that we look forward to this homeland that these faithful people in Hebrews 11 looked for. We look for that homeland which is being made ready for us as we speak. Verse 16. But now they desire a better, that is, a heavenly country. Therefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. Their permanent home is being prepared and is going to be brought to this earth. That homeland is what this feast is all about. That's what the Feast of Tabernacles is about, looking forward to that homeland, to the kingdom of God on this earth, which Christ will bring with him when he returns, and he will set it up, and he will rule all nations. That's what we look forward to. That's what we talk about at the feast. We go to this feast of temporary dwellings. We stay in a temporary dwelling. We recognize that our existence on this planet is an existence in a temporary home, and we look forward to that permanent home. One of the instructions regards where the feasts are to be kept. We're to keep the feast where God places his name. Deuteronomy chapter 16, verse 13. Deuteronomy 16, verse 13. You shall observe the Feast of Tabernacles 7 days, when you have gathered from your threshing floor and from your winepress. And you shall rejoice in your feast, you and your son and your daughter, your male servant and your female servant, and the Levite, the stranger and the fatherless and the widow who are within your gates. 7 days you shall keep a sacred feast to the Lord your God in the place which the Lord chooses, because the Lord your God will bless you in all your produce and in all the work of your hands, so that you surely rejoice. The feast is to be kept wherever God chooses to place his name. This might be some distance, and may include several overnight stays, just to get there and get home. God knows that this is going to be at considerable expense to us. He knows that it's not going to be cheap. But he wanted his people to really enjoy these days. He wants his people to rejoice, to celebrate, to look forward to this feast. He even commands us to rejoice. Now, I don't know why we need to be commanded to rejoice. Anybody tells me to have a good time, they don't have to tell me twice usually. You know, I'm going to say, okay, let's have a good time. I like having a good time. But God commands us to rejoice in these days because they are important to him. They mean something. And they should be important to us because they mean something. Because they are so important, God has provided a way, even though it might cost something, God has provided a way for us to finance it. Let's back up a couple chapters. Deuteronomy 14, verse 22. Deuteronomy 14, verse 22. You shall truly tithe all the increase of your grain that the field produces year by year. And you shall eat before the Lord your God in the place where he chooses to make his name abide, the tithe of your grain and your new wine and your oil, of the firstborn of your herds and your flocks, that you may learn to fear the Lord your God always. The festival tithe, or we call it the second tithe, was to be stored up, saved for use at the feast. There are some who will argue that this was the same as the first tithe that they carried to the feast with them. But I tell you that that is not true. This is a separate tithe. This is the second tithe, or the festival tithe. The disposition of these two tithes was totally different. Regarding the first tithe, the individual who gives his tithe has no say in where that tithe goes. He has no say in how that tithe is used. But the individual retains complete control over the disposition of the second tithe, or the festival tithe. This tithe was to be eaten. It was not given to the Levites. It was to be eaten by the tithe giver. Now, in ancient Israel, it was an agrarian society, and tithes were usually not cash like they would be today. In those days, tithes usually consisted of livestock or of produce. It was a farming society. Regular tithes were given to the Levites. This was separate. This was a second tithe. This was set apart and was not to be consumed just anywhere. It was not given to the Levites, and it was not to be consumed just anywhere. It was only to be eaten at the place where God placed his name. In other words, it was only for festival use. Now, for some people, this would be a difficult trip with 10% of their annual increase. If they raised cattle, they maybe had 200 cattle born to them during the year. You'd have to go to the feast and carry 20 cows with them. 10%. That would be pretty cumbersome. Or if they raised produce, they'd have to carry a couple of tons of produce with them. That could be difficult. God allowed for that too. He explained how this could be handled in verse 24. But if the journey is too long for you so that you're not able to carry the tithe, or if the place where the Lord your God chooses to put his name is too far from you, when the Lord your God has blessed you, then you shall exchange it for money. Take the money in your hand and go to the place which the Lord your God chooses. So instead of carrying the tithe, it could be liquidated. The important thing was that it was to be enjoyed. It was to be used for rejoicing. That's what God wanted. He wanted to make sure that people rejoiced in his feast. Notice verse 26. And you shall spend that money for whatever your heart desires, for oxen or sheep, for wine or similar drink, for whatever your heart desires. You shall eat there before the Lord your God, and you shall rejoice, you and your household. God wanted his people to look forward to these days. That's why they're to be joyous, festive occasions. He wants us to look forward to them as something exciting. When we have 10% of our yearly income at our disposal to use in just over 1 week, when you do the math, that works out to about 4 times your average standard of living. And I don't care how much you make, I don't care if you're a millionaire or if you're on welfare, 4 times your average standard of living is going to seem like a big difference. And it's going to really make you happy when you can go out and spend it. God wanted us to enjoy abundance. There is a proper use for the festival tithe. The verse we just read, Deuteronomy 14:26, says, "You shall eat there." Where is there? There is the place where God chose to place his name. The festival tithe is not for use outside of the feast location or within your gates, as it says. It is for use at the feast. We are to consume it in conjunction with keeping the feast. You shall eat there before the Lord your God. We're eating our 10% of our increase for the year in God's presence, in his presence at his feast. And it follows that we should not use that tithe for anything that is inappropriate or ungodly, because we are eating it before God. Now we go to the feast and we spend what we have. We spend our festival tithe on various things like lodging and meals and transportation. We might also spend some of it on entertainment. We want to make sure that any entertainment that we enjoy at the feast is godly entertainment. You have to watch some of the worldly entertainment, because oftentimes it can get pretty vulgar. That would not be a good use of our festival tithe, because we're eating before God. Before God means that he should approve of how we are using it. I don't think it would be a good use to go to the feast and spend our tithes on something that God will not approve of, something he would consider inappropriate. So we want to be careful about things like that. And you shall rejoice, it says, the latter part of verse 26. And you shall rejoice. That's we and our families together. And whatever we spend that tithe on should be something that makes us happy, something that makes us rejoice. That's the idea. We use it in a celebratory mode as God intended. Now we want to remember not just ourselves, but other family members. If we have children, of course we want to make sure that they rejoice as well. And so it's fine to get gifts for the children during this time. It's fine to go out and purchase things that the kids can use while they're at the feast, and something that will make them rejoice. You know, something that they wouldn't be able to get at home perhaps. It's fine to get gifts. It's fine to get gifts for your family. It's not a requirement of the feast. Don't think that you have to go out and get gifts for everybody in the family when you go to the feast. It's not necessary. But it certainly can make your children enjoy the feast a little more, and maybe your spouse as well. You know, get things for your husband or your wife. That's fine. Treating yourself is fine. You see something that you like, you want to buy it for yourself, that's fine, if it's going to enhance your feast. Now, if you're walking down the street at the feast and you happen to pass by a shop and in the window you see something that catches your eye and you can afford it, it's within budget, no problem. Buy it. If it's going to enhance your feast, buy it. Now, by seeing something in a shop window, I don't mean a Lamborghini dealer. Understand you understand what I mean. I don't mean a down payment on a car that you've been wanting. That's not something that would enhance your feast. It would enhance your entire life. But, or maybe it would ruin you. I don't know. But I'm not talking about something like that. I'm not talking about, oh, let's get a new TV for the family room. That's not something that's going to enhance your feast. It's going to enhance your home when you get back home. That wouldn't be a good use for it. But something that would enhance your feast certainly is perfectly acceptable. One other thing to consider is that it's also good to think of those who are less fortunate, or who don't have as much festival tithe as you do, or perhaps someone who is on a fixed income that you can maybe take out to dinner, maybe help them out a little bit, maybe even give them a few dollars that they can rejoice as well. It's good to think of other people as well. Verse 27 in Deuteronomy 14 mentions something along this same line, along this principle. Verse 27 says, "You shall not forsake the Levite who is within your gates, for he has no part nor inheritance with you." And of course, this is referring to the Levites, but the principle is the same. The principle is the same, that we should consider those who don't have the festival tithe, those who don't have increase. If you don't have increase, you don't have 10% of your increase. 10% of nothing is nothing. And so some of us, especially those who are elderly or just live on Social Security, don't have tithe as the rest of us do. And so it's good to consider them and not forsake them. Help them out, if possible. Obviously, there are some things that you need to take care of prior to the feast to help you rejoice the way God wants you to help make these days special. There are some feast expenses that are paid while you're still at home. And when it says to spend this money at the place where the Lord chooses, you know, it's understood that some things do have to be paid in advance, but they are for the purpose of enjoying the feast. And I'm talking about things like airfare, housing deposits, and other pay-in-advance items, things that you have to put the money up front before you go. And that's understood. These things are instrumental to our enjoyment of the feast. Such things do not violate the command to eat there at the place where God chooses. If you're staying in a condo or perhaps even a campsite at the feast, you need to prepare. You need to be ready when you get there. And that means you may need to stock up some groceries or some other supplies for your stay when you get there. So there are certain things that you might have to do before the feast that you could use this money for. Some of these things might need to be bought before you leave home. Sometimes we might spend money at home to enhance the feast. Some of the ladies might want to go out and get a new outfit or get their hair done so that they can have a more enjoyable feast. They can feel better. Things that make them feel more joyful at the feast. Perfectly okay. No problem with that. That's fine. A man might want to go out and get a new suit before he gets to the feast, so he has a new suit to wear at the feast. The test is it going to enhance the feast, the overall feast experience, or not? If it does, then it falls within the guidelines of the festival tithe. There are some things that will be inappropriate use of it. As I said, a new outfit for the feast is fine, but restocking your entire wardrobe, not fine. Okay, that's not the purpose. Getting all new clothes, some of which won't even be worn at the feast. You know, it's not going to enhance your feast if you just wait till you get home to wear it. Taking advantage of the extra money you have on hand to buy things that are needed for the home. Inappropriate way of using the festival tithe. The tithe is not intended for everyday operating expenses. It's inappropriate to get new things for the house just because it's feast time. You know, that's not enhancing the feast itself. It's supposed to be a special time. It's supposed to be a rejoicing time, a time that we can come before God and enjoy what He has blessed us with. What about any tithe that you have that's left over after the feast is over? What happens to that? You didn't spend it, so maybe you can use it for anything you want? Well, no, I don't think so. The tithe is still set apart for specific use, even if it's left over. So you might want to consider giving it to someone who doesn't have as much, someone who maybe went to the feast this year on a limited budget. You know they're going to have the same problem next year, so maybe you give it to them and help them to have a more enjoyable feast next time. You know, things like that that you can do to enhance either your feast or someone else's. That would be an appropriate use of the tithe. Obviously, there are reasons why one might not attend the feast, perhaps going through health challenges or family emergencies that might play a part in your not being able to attend. With the exception of maybe a chronic illness, these are the exception and not the rule. Perhaps there's a new baby due at feast time. If your due date is right in the middle of the feast, it's most advisable that you not attend. You know, we don't think it's a good idea for babies to be born at the feast. It's not a good idea for the mother or the child. You know, what's in the best interest, health-wise, for both? And so that would be certainly a legitimate reason for not going, for not attending. But despite the fact that we go to the feast and rejoice, there are still some people who will use excuses for not attending. There are still some who will have a reason why they can't attend, and sometimes it's year after year after year. I don't understand why anyone would not want to go and rejoice. But some always seem to have a reason why they can't go. Not being able to get off work is not an excuse. You know, you have a responsibility to have your schedule cleared because you have an appointment with God. And that appointment predates anything else that is on your schedule. I knew a man one time. He was an elderly man. He hadn't been in the church very long. And I had asked him about where he was going to the feast, and he said, "Well, I'm not going to be able to go." And this was almost 20 years ago, a long time. He's long since died, but I asked him where he was going. He said he wouldn't be able to go, and I asked him why. He said, well, his doctor had scheduled him for a procedure, and it was right in the middle of the feast, and he wouldn't be able to come because he had to get this procedure done. Now, it wasn't anything that was life and death. It wasn't anything that needed to be done on that date, but he didn't make the effort to reschedule it for another time. He allowed a medical appointment that wasn't necessary, it wasn't vital that he had it done there, to interfere with his appointment with God. God gave us these days for a reason. They are vital to our spiritual growth. They are important. They help us understand the plan of God for man. They spell out that plan step by step. Those with a genuine need, those who are on a fixed income, are able to get assistance for the feast. If you can't go because of finances and there's a genuine need, there is assistance available. Those who are new to the church, who maybe don't have a full year's festival tithe and aren't able to attend, the church does offer assistance to those with genuine need. See, God gave us this time for our enjoyment and our pleasure. And there should be nothing standing in the way of us obeying that command to rejoice. So God gives us a way that we can afford it. He gives us the instruction about the festival tithe. And if that still doesn't give us enough, the church does offer assistance. And that's not charity. I know some people will say, well, I don't want to accept any charity. It's not charity. You're not receiving charity. You're receiving help to do something that God commands you to do. As these days approach, and they are approaching fast, just a few weeks now, remember how important these holy days are. These days are important to God. And they should be equally important to us. Remember that you have an appointment with God on these days. It's important that you not miss your appointment. It's important that you not be late for your appointment. Faithfully saving and using the festival tithe will help you rejoice in these days. And God will bless you if you use it to honor Him. That's exactly what we do when we come before Him to rejoice in His holy days.